Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library, otherwise known as Live from the New York Public Library. You've heard me say this 100 times. My goal here at the library is simply to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when I'm successful, actually to make it levitate. It's a great pleasure tonight to have Adam Phillips here. And before bringing him on stage tonight, we will be showing a short clip of a poet who I know matters greatly to Adam Phillips. I want you to pay particular attention to him and particular attention to what he will be saying, because in many ways I see great affinity between what this particular poet, W.S. Merwin, says and Adam Phillips' way of thinking, way of viewing the world. So without further ado, I want you now to listen carefully, and after that, Adam and I will have a conversation which will be about as long as a psychoanalytical conversation. I say that each and every time, but my goodness, is it different tonight if your shrink is generous. So, here we go. As I was thinking about this notion of inviting you tonight, because the trip from Hawaii to Washington is rather long, I thought it would be a good thing for you to stop in New York before you take your honors, as it were, at the Library of Congress and become officially, I suppose, the poet laureate. I wanted you to stop here and honor us, but I was equally perplexed by the fact that though I've interviewed a lot of people and been in conversation with a lot of people over the last 14 or 15 years that I've been doing this strange métier, I have never spoken to a poet.
It's pretty scary, isn't it?
It's pretty scary, but it also made me reflect, how does one ask a question to a poet?
What question do you want to ask?
Well, before asking a question, I knew it wouldn't be easy, you see. Before asking a question, I would like you to read a poem.
Neither my father nor my mother knew the names of the trees when I was born, where I was born. What is that, I asked, and my father and mother did not hear. They did not look where I pointed. Surfaces of furniture held the attention of their fingers, and across the room they could watch walls they had forgotten, where there were no questions, no voices, and no shade. Were there trees where they were children? Where I had not been then, I asked. Were there trees in those places where my father and my mother were born? And at that time, did my father and my mother see them? And when they said yes, it meant they did not remember. What were they, I asked? What were they? But both my father and my mother said they never knew. I think I notice this with children often and adults. Sometimes it's as though they were speaking different languages to each other. Sometimes it's very intimate and you see that they are communicating. Sometimes they're talking different planes and different directions, and not hearing each other. And, and parents very often can't answer their children's questions. And so, you know, in a sense, they don't hear the question.
The noise of questions.
The noise of questions. What about it? I mean, we're part of the time we're always asking those questions. What does the word mean? That's the first question. There's probably a smaller audience for poetry than there's ever been in any great language. But at the same time, I'm convinced that poetry is natural to everybody, and that children grow up with the making of poetry in them. And it's this need to handle words in a way that will express the inexpressible is always with us. It's always there, the sense of inadequacy. The feeling that when one says thank you and really means it, it's never enough. This is a kind of experience that we run through in our lives all the time without realizing what it is. So when you, Paul, with your background, say you've given up poetry, that's what I say. I think it's ridiculous. That man that you're telling me about in San Diego, his life was going to pieces because he met an old teacher on the street who taught him poetry in a course that he'd taken for the pleasure of it. And the man said, asked him about his life, and he said, well, I don't know, it's not going very well. And the man said, are you still reading poetry? And he said, no, I don't have time for it. He said, what are you talking about? It takes you a couple of minutes a day. Why don't you read one poem a day that you like for pleasure? Pleasure is very important to it. And he thought, God, it's true. My wife says I curse in the shower in the morning. And I set out for work furious. And he said, I'm going to try to read a poem before I get into the shower. And he said it changed. That really worked and made a big difference to his life. But I think anything that brings one back, because I think that this is a root experience, this thing of expression of the inexpressible and trying to do it, and the pleasure that's involved in it. That's why the Puritans closed the theaters and for bad poetry in the 17th century. The joy of, and you know, I was at Poets' House yesterday, and they have children's programs, and the children are running around saying, talking about what fun it is to memorize poetry, and to suddenly start remembering lines of poetry. Well, you know, if they come at it 5 years later, not having done it, they'll say, I can't remember, I can't memorize things, I can't do it, you know. And there's this resistance that's grown in. If they start early enough, they realize it's fun and that they've got something that they can carry around with them and have fun with.
The expression of the inexpressible. Also how the dissonance between children and grown-ups.
But the reason it seemed to me a wonderful poem was because it was about how children are always up against their parents' self-preoccupation. That in talking to your parents, of course your parents have their history and their preoccupations with them. And that very strange experience as a child where on the one hand you assume they could only be attentive to you, and you also know that they're, as it were, in their own minds. And the poem is very poignant about that, about how you can't, as a child, you can't quite, however responsive your parents are, there's always a sense in which the response is inadequate. And either that prompts you to be more, as it were, poetic, or it creates a kind of retreat, and you kind of give up, like the man who swears in the shower.
What does poetry afford us that other languages can't?
I'm not sure, I don't know really what the answer to that is, but there is something, I think, in what Merwin has said, which of course comes from, in a way, Romanticism, which is about the idea that that children speak a language that is a very fundamental language, even though, or because it's less sophisticated. That the mere fact that children are new people means they're coming
New people.
Yeah. So they're coming to the tools that everybody has completely fresh. And what it means is that they show the adults things about the language that the adults have forgotten. The other bit...
Forgotten?
Forgotten in the sense that there's such an elaborated sophistication by the time you get to be an adult. So you've got so many ways of saying and not saying things. So one of the very interesting things about doing child psychotherapy is that you can say anything to a child because it's either water off a duck's back and they're just not interested, or they're completely gripped. There's very little middle ground. So you see children are really alive and enlivened by certain things you say, but if they aren't engaged, they're not engaged at all. And you can see they just manage you. They learn to manage the adults who've got all these things to say, many of which they're not interested in.
How do you manage their distraction?
Well, I'd partly allow for it, as in, you know, that they should be free to do that. But I would want to engage them. But it's a real lesson in the way in which children drop adults more than adults drop children. Because children actually are only interested in adults when they're interested. And of course they evolve ways of pretending.
So they're honest.
I don't know if they're honest exactly. But they're... The trouble is, all the words are not quite right.
This will happen tonight a lot, is that a lot of the words we use won't be quite right.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think that children are not truer, realer, more passionate, more profound. I don't think any of that's true. But they are new people. So they're beginning, they're starting it out.
I mean, they're infants in the true sense.
And they're also born into the atmosphere, the emotional climate of their parents' histories and characters.
But what happens to us? Because, you know, in thinking about the ways in which you talk about children, I'm reminded, this happens all the time in the experience of reading you, I'm reminded of the great Eighth Elegy of Rilke, where Rilke talks about us being turned around. Something, we've been turned around from the open space in which we existed. Animals existed, children existed, and confines are put on us. He says in German, wer hat das so umgedreht, who turned and twisted us around so much. And that's what happens. We lose something in the process. Mm. In the process of being less new, we lose something. We lose the ability maybe to name things.
In one of Berryman's dream songs, he has the line, Rilke was a jerk. Do you remember that?
No.
It's a very,
no,
very good
what I mean
by saying this, whether or not one thinks it's true, is that the trouble with that Rilke stuff is, to me, there's something very precious about it. I mean, I can see the point of it, and I can see there's something poignant about it. I also think that, in a way, it's very simple, this, which is that parenting is very, very selective. It's not unconditional love, that parents love and like certain things about their children and don't love and like other things. And children, of course, adapt to this and pick it up. So very soon, there are whole reams and realms of experience and feeling and thought that simply cannot be articulated in the family. And this is true of all families, because it's like an aesthetic criteria. The child picks up very quickly what is lovable about him or her and what isn't, and has to deal with that, and that we've all dealt with that. That's what growing up involves. But what it means is that it leaves us with fantasies of an endless, unrealized potential. And modern people often think things like, if only I'd had different parents, then. Whereas, of course, the point is you do only have the parents you have. That's the point of your life. There weren't other parents. And that's what you're actually dealing with. And it always involves something that could either be called a sacrifice or relinquishment, or a denial, or something. And then what seems to happen is that the very things that were left out, so to speak, or unrecognized or unacknowledged, press for recognition in adolescence and adulthood. It's almost as though we're always trying to partly fill in the gaps in our parents' capacity to recognize us, or we give up.
What we attempt to do as parents, to wish for other parents, we do in relationships we have with each other, and particularly in a relationship you're interested in, as am I, the relationship with one's partner, one's lover. One, in your new book, Missing Out, you have a passage where you describe the wish, if only he or she were different. If only she or he were somewhat able to change the way I would wish them to change.
But what's very striking about that thought, and it's very vivid, obviously, when you do psychoanalysis, but obviously everybody has these conversations, is how much people feel they know what their lives would be exactly like were their partner to change in this desired way. as though this is really a specification, that if only they would do this, then everything else would follow. And everybody at a moment thought, well, no, that couldn't possibly be true. So one's living in a very strange, omnipotent, omniscient fantasy about...
A dangerous one.
Well, a sort of very, very violent one, because the coercion is a magical one. It's saying to the other person, if only you could be more tidy, we'd be happy together. If only you could be whatever it is. And it's going to be located somewhere.
The example you choose is very apropos.
To what?
To me. I feel that.
And are you the messy one? Or the?
I am the messy one. I live my life, as I often say, between chaos and entropy, somewhere where the two meet. But you're also very interested, and this is a digression, you're also very interested in messiness. You're very interested in...
Is anybody not? I mean, I you may be right. It's just that it seems to me that one of the things, the way that the language divides this up in a kind of binary, is that there's mess and chaos, and there's order and something else. And clearly it isn't as simple as that. But very often between couples you will find that one of the... Given couples only ever have three or four arguments of their own specific repertoire, one of them very often is about order.
What is that about?
Well, we couldn't generalize about that, but I think it could be about, for example, a fear of a sort of emotional chaos, or feeling being excessive, unintelligible, too much to manage in some way. Because you could think, well, what's the fantasy of catastrophe here? Let's imagine the house gets totally messy. What's going to happen? Well, you know, there won't be a catastrophe, but one thing will happen, for example, is that we won't be able to find anything. And that's a very odd thing. So in each case, presumably, somebody's got a fantasy of the catastrophe that will occur if the person doesn't change.
Mess also is a way of hiding things from oneself.
Could be, yeah. I mean, Mary Douglas said this thing about dirt is matter out of order.
Out of place, yeah.
And that seems to be a very good sort of formulation for this. And that everybody's going to be preoccupied with something to do with dirt, hygiene, order, intelligibility, given the kind of cultures we've grown up in.
Your new book, Missing Out in Praise of the Unlived Life, is very much about this strong, I mean, insofar that it is about something, which itself is a dangerous comment. But it is about, to some extent, the great attachment we have to a life we fully imagine but are absolutely not living.
Yeah.
And it feels hard in some way not to take it to heart. The unexamined life, you write, is surely worth living. This is in the prologue. But is the unlived life worth examining? It seems a strange question until one realizes how much of our so-called mental life is about the lives we're not living, the lives we're missing out on, the lives we would be leading, but for some reason are not. And in some way, that first line is, you're truly putting Plato on his head.
Am I?
Yes. Insofar, and Plato was maybe also a jerk, but you're putting Plato on his head by saying, I mean, Plato believed deeply that the unexamined life was not worth living. And here, what you're doing is imagining in some way that our greatest fantasy is about a life not lived.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
we're
not
intentionally missing out, but missing out.
Well, I think there's a tremendous snobism in believing that only examined lives are worth living. Because clearly there are all sorts of lives, and no one's in a position to decide that. But what is unavoidably true is that we are, and this starts inevitably right from the beginning of our lives, we're fantasizing about what we don't have. That's what fantasy is, effectively. So it's an imagining of a felt absence or deprivation. And I think the question is, what happens to that fantasize? Because you think of it very simply in terms of that, a lot of people, I think, will be familiar with the story. But if you think of a baby, and this is a construction, because obviously nobody knows what babies think, but the baby's hungry, it fantasizes what it wants to eat. And it waits. And if it waits too long, then this turns into rage. And then it might be very difficult for it to eat. But if it comes within a sufficient amount of time, then the baby can enjoy the meal. But a lot happens in this process, because first of all, the child registered, in an immediate sense, a need. Then there's a fantasy about what would satisfy it. And then, ideally, it meets the reality of what will approximately satisfy it. And everything depends upon what happens in that process. Because if the child waits, and it's very familiar, this, that if we're looking forward to seeing somebody and we wait too long for them, we can't be with them when they arrive.
You know, it's amazing that you mentioned that, because in some way your book is an elegy to the fact that we're not special.
Yeah.
That in some way we begin our life new, thinking we are highly original, highly special. And growing up is a slow but sure process of realizing that we really are not.
Well,
and just to continue with using the same example as you used of waiting, I don't know if you remember in Fragments of a Lover's Discourse in Bach, there's a great passage on waiting. A lover waits.
Yeah. It's never the other who waits.
It's never the other who waits. Mm-hmm. He or she waits, Bach is never clear about gender, waits and realizes that waiting is not a particularly good thing to be doing. So he goes out and walks around the block so that he shouldn't be put in that position of waiting. Mm. Then comes back and the lover is still not there, and he does the same thing until they finally meet. And the lover feels terribly original in doing this. But what Bach talks about in Fragments of a Lover's Discourse is that everybody does this all the time. And therefore, our specialness is very much put into question.
Yes, I mean, it seems to me we are all original, but we aren't all special, in the sense that, ideally, our parents make us feel special insofar as they can, they organize their lives around our needs. So we begin, ideally, with a sense that it doesn't matter to somebody else that we have a need, and it matters to somebody else that they will find out what that need might be and do what they can about it. But in the process of growing up, it's going to dawn on everybody that there's scarcity, and that there's a limit to how much anybody can have, and that there are an awful lot of people in the world. So it's very unlikely that anybody's going to outgrow this experience, which is, on the one hand, if you're lucky, a feeling that somebody cares enough about what you're feeling to think about what you need, and then you will then grow up into a world in which people will do this less reliably, probably. Because you'll never have that kind of intimacy as an adult with an adult lover as you had with your parents. It's not the same, but you will never have that kind of attentiveness to your need. And that is, I think, the thing that makes all the difference. But I think the other thing that's worth picking up in the Bart example is that this story is potentially very violent and disturbing, because it's not simply when you wait, it gets worse and worse and worse. It's that when you wait, you either become, if you wait too long, either vengeful and destroy the world that makes you wait, or defeated, you give up on your desire because you can't bear the waiting involved. So everything hangs on, it seems to me, what that waiting experience is like. And then later, it'll hang on how the people you find yourself falling for, deal with the waiting question, whether they keep you waiting, whether they anticipate they will have to wait for you. All that stuff is going to be repeated. But
it is a question of timing.
It's a question of time. It's a question of imagining what the other person can bear and what you might be doing to somebody by making them wait.
And how much can they bear before it becomes unbearable?
And also, why do you want to make them bear something?
Why do you?
Well, you might want to sadistically make them feel that they're the needy ones and you're beyond need. I mean, a basic sadomasochistic arrangement would be the sadist believes, I can do whatever I like to you because you'll never be able to leave me. And the masochist says, you can do anything you want to me as long as you never leave me. And that's the basic, one of the basic sort of patterns of this. So how waiting is exploited between couples or between people is very powerful, I think.
And it brings us to the core of the book, missing out. In the prologue still, you say, we also learn to live somewhere between the lives we have and the lives we would like. The book is about some versions of these double lives we can't help but live. There's always what will turn out to be life, the life we led, and the life that accompanied it, the parallel life or lives that never actually happened, that we lived in our minds, the wished for life or lives, the risk untaken, and the opportunities avoided or unprovided. We refer to them as our unlived lives because somewhere we believe that they were open to us. But for some reason, and we might spend a great deal of our lived lives trying to find and give the reason, they were not possible. And what was not possible all too easily becomes the story of our lives. Indeed, our lived lives might become a protracted mourning for or an endless tantrum about the lives you were unable to live. I get to comment on that.
The book's the comment on that.
Yeah.
The book is really about frustration. And it's about the unavoidable nature of frustration and about what we end up doing with the experience of frustration. Because I think it's in praise of the unlived life, in the sense that there's always going to be a large amount of unlived life. We're always going to have a sense of an excessive sense of our own potential, or simply an unrealistic one, because one couldn't know what one's own potential is, and one can never know the contingent circumstances one's going to live one's life in. But whatever those circumstances are, there's always going to be frustration, and there's always going to be the response to it. And so, in a way, the book says something very simple. It sort of reinvents the wheel, in a way. It just says this, that if we feel phobic of frustration, if we can't bear our own frustration, then we are never going to be remotely satisfied. That it's only in a state of frustration that's held or tolerated that you can begin to find what it is you might want. And if you live in a culture which is always offering you fairly instantaneous, if you're affluent enough, satisfactions, then you're very likely to learn to fob yourself off and never to get to the point where you might have more of a sense of what you might want.
More of a sense in some way of waiting.
Exactly, of being actually able to wait and assuming
anticipating
that
in some way. I mean, a culture which doesn't permit foreplay is a culture which is lost.
Should we just pause at that moment? Yes. Certainly a culture that...
But
let me just finish.
Okay.
If we live in a culture that discourages states of anticipation, or that it assumes that really we can't bear it, or that it'll drive us mad, or we'll get too anxious, then what that means is all the imaginative space that frustration opens up is foreclosed. So it's as though I feel slightly restless or agitated. I have a bar of chocolate. I have a bath. I phone somebody, etc. And we all do a version of this. What's very difficult is to actually hold that state so one can get more of a sense of what it is one might want. Because what happens is, very quickly, the way one fobs oneself off becomes an addiction. Every time I'm a bit restless, I eat chocolate. And that becomes simply what I do. And then we're left with a whole range of unformulated needs or desires. Because every time I feel this state of sort of restless agitation, chocolate comes to mind. And even though I know it doesn't satisfy me, that's what I will do. And, you know, lives are based on things like that.
Like chocolate.
Chocolate. So that the book is saying, if we can bear our children's frustration, because it's very difficult to let one's children be frustrated, because most people can't bear being hated by their children. And childhood is intrinsically frustrating, but if the parents can let their children wait, the children can then find that they're more able to imagine and dream and so on. So that, and in fact, frustration should be taught in schools. It should be a subject, because children know a lot about frustration, and they need languages about it that make it more alluring and interesting and intriguing, rather than just terrible or frightening or whatever. So it would be very good if, I think, educationally if that was done. But I think it...
But it's it sounds flippant, but it's actually quite serious.
No, I mean it.
I know you mean it. And in a way, it could be a subject taught in introducing children and maybe adolescents to political philosophy.
Absolutely, yeah. Or drama, or their whole range of things.
But by political philosophy and politics, I actually mean that a response to a society which doesn't accept frustration is a consumer society that immediately offers what people supposedly imagine they want. Mm.
But it's, in a way, it's worse than that, I think, because I think two things happen.
One that's is pretty that bad already.
No, it is bad already. One thing that happens is that people are habitually fobbed off, so they don't know what they want.
What is that word exactly?
It means being placated. So instead of it being us really working out what you want for dinner tonight, I say, we're having pizza. And that's it. That's the end of the conversation. Okay? So it's a foreclosing of the issue. So mother says to the child, do you want apple juice or orange juice? And the question is whether the child can think beyond those two, or whether that constrains the repertoire. See what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So, in the frustration story that I'm trying to push here, the two things can happen, I think. One is that we don't discover our satisfactions. The other thing is that we turn being frustrated into a pleasure, into a masochistic pleasure. So we begin to enjoy our deprivation. And once that happens, it's very, very difficult, I think, for anything to shift.
But on the other hand, in missing out, and in your work in general, and we'll get to the ways in which missing out is part of your work in general, you find that frustration comes with a certain form of optimism, and that we really, really need it.
Yeah.
We need it in order to be poetic, in order to be imaginative.
Or to think, yeah, exactly.
In order to think. Yeah, we need the incitation, maybe, the invitation that reading itself, which I'll get to in a moment, offers us. Frustration is part of it.
Yes,
and
it's a kind of hope or a kind of faith. When you're frustrated initially, you have the hope or the faith or the belief that there is something in the world that might satisfy you or might at least appease something of your frustration. So it's a real frustration is a real belief in the future. In its first stage, and then everything hangs on what happens next. But it's very, very optimistic in principle.
There's a line that you quote in many books, and that's something that I want to talk to you about. Is the quotation of certain lines in many books, because I think, to some extent, Adam, we share this. I mean, you write it, I say it. You have a group of quotations that come back again and again and again. And people think I have an enormous amount of quotations in my mind, but I really only have half a dozen. They're very good. I mean, one of my very favorite is Oscar Wilde, who said that there's only superficial people who do not judge by appearance. I always love that. And when I say that, people are always amazed by the fact that I remember all these quotations, but they are few. And in reading your oeuvre, as it were, in the last few weeks, I've come across certain quotations that matter to you very much. And this one is, I think, apropos, many of them are, but this one of Marshall Salins I like very much. A people who conceive life to be the pursuit of happiness must be chronically unhappy. I'll leave it there. I mentioned a moment ago just a few quotations. I'd like you to take me back, if you could, to the moment actually when you discovered reading, and when reading started to matter to you. the as it were, the crime scene. That moment when reading became something more than just reading words on a page.
I was actually, as a child, I wasn't interested in reading at all. But when I went to school, as a sort of adolescent, I had a school, an English teacher, who talked about literature with the same kind of passion that my family talked about each other. In other words, there was a kind of intensity in this engagement that I'd never heard before. And it was very, very contagious and very, very inspiring. And he was, I don't know, what, obviously because I don't know who's here, but I had a teacher who'd been taught by Leavis at Cambridge. And Leavis was a literature critic in England who really treated English literature as a kind of secular religion. It was a kind of answer to what he thought was a post-Christian society. And my teacher at school felt something comparably zealous. It wasn't zealous as in we were told exactly what to read and what to think about the books, but it was conveyed to us that these books really did matter and that you were involved in some rearguard action for the profound human values in reading these books. And that was conveyed very, very powerfully, that the way to learn how to live and to live properly was to read English literature. And it worked for me. I mean, that's it. I felt it.
And it was immersive.
It was totally immersive, yeah.
You know what comes to my mind as you say this? Is that you rebelled against it.
In that?
In that your teacher may have taught you that literature in some way answers such and such questions. In more than one way, I think that what you teach us, and I think the way in which you live literature, if I can presume that I know that, is precisely believing that it's only an incitation. It's only an invitation. You don't quite know what it offers. You don't quite know what it promises. But it does something.
Yes, if you happen to like reading, it has a very powerful effect on you, an evocative effect, or at least on me, so that it's not as though when I read I'm gathering information or indeed can remember much of what I read, but it is like dream work in the sense that I can feel it having an effect on me, and I know the books that grip me, as everybody does, but their effect is indiscernible. I don't quite know what it is. The Leaverside position is that it, more or less, is that it makes you a morally better person. Well, it seems to me that isn't clear, but what is
it
clear?
It isn't clear,
not to me, no. But what is clear is that there are very powerful unconscious evocative effects in reading books that one loves. And it's a bit like what you were saying about having the same repertoire of quotations, because presumably we have these repertoires because there's something about these quotes that we want to go on thinking about, that matter to us. They're not just sort of fetishes that we use to fill gaps.
I believe
they're like dreams that we remember.
They are, and in some way they, well, in my professional life, they serve me very well. But they serve me because they're not name-dropping in the sense that they are there because they help me think. They help me further my way of being. They are the words I wish I had had. Yeah. But I have to attribute them to someone else.
Well, that's true of all our words. But that's true of most of our words. I mean, they're somebody else's. But it's very selective, isn't it? Because you've read however many hundreds, thousands of books you've read. But certain quotations have stayed to haunt you.
And
that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because, you know, why those 6 or 8 or 10 or whatever they are? And you might think, well, and I'm sure it's true, they're useful, they're pragmatically... You can use them in situations.
But why?
Well, because presumably you want them redescribed. There's still something in them you want to know about. So hold on a second.
Yeah.
So that actually, every time you use it, it's like a love test. It's a bit like the Merwin poem, which is that you say it again, say to me or to the audience or whatever it is, and my assumption is that unconsciously, so to speak, you're wondering what's going to come back when you say it. And that's an attempt to go on working out what is in it for you.
So it's hopeful.
It's full of desire, but you don't know what it is you want. But you do need to go on saying it, because you want to find out what it will elicit.
Again and again and again.
As long as it takes. Because when you've, as it were, got what you wanted, it'll disappear.
The reaction to that is, I mean, when you say that, I think of it, and I think how sad that. I mean, what a relief it would be for some people who wouldn't, who wouldn't have to hear this over and over again.
No, but it could be a relief for you, because what it would mean is the story's moved on, and you would then be freer to have another one.
Okay, I didn't want you to say that, but.
You see, that would be a good example of the way in which things can be anxiously held onto as a kind of set of tools for fear of what would happen were they to be relinquished. Now, you could actually change your...
Repertoire.
As we all could. But certain things would be clung onto.
But you hold on to your repertoire a lot.
Yeah.
Why?
I think for the reason I'm saying, because there's something about these quotations, whichever they are, that go on preoccupying me in some way. And they come to mind, when I write, they come to mind. So they get recontextualized every time they're written down. And because they're like dreams in that sense. There's something in them that matters, and I don't know what it is. So I go on repeating them. And people do say it's back to
me. And in a way, that is, again, brings us back to Merwin, something that we can't quite formulate.
Yes, but the thing about the Merwin poem is that it seems to me he's saying there in the poem that you can't quite formulate it if no one responds to it. That if your parents are preoccupied in that way, you're always stuck with this feeling that you can't get beyond a certain point. Because what you're wanting is the response that makes a difference, that is a redescription. So you get something back that modifies what you've said. And that's the point of talking.
And most of your life is spent, well, maybe not most of your life, but a lot of your life is spent listening.
Yeah. But what I've described to you is what psychoanalysis is. Because that's what you're intimating.
I realize.
People say things to you and you say things back to them. That's all it is. And people say things to you and you're entirely dependent on what occurs to you. It's simply about what occurs to you in that conversation and what's sayable. And whether the two people feel, for whatever reason, this is worth going on with. That there's some appetite in it. That even if you can't say why, you want to go on with the conversation. It feels necessary to you. Because everybody's got their set of quotations, even if they're not literally quotes. They're just stories about who I am. You know, I'm a very shy person. My mother was this, my father was that. We've all got this repertoire of kind of stultified formulas about who we are. And they're there, presumably partly because we want to unpack them, and partly because there's a lot of anxiety in not thinking them. So people come to analysis or talk to their friends or whatever to have these things renewed or revised, even though at the same time they would be anxious about that happening.
I was going to say, the desire for change is also filled with trepidation.
Yeah.
And in some way, analysis is but another form of reading, or rather rereading.
Yeah. It's another form of reading. It's another form of... coming back from school as a child and chatting with your mother around the kitchen table. They're all similar sorts of things in which whatever your preoccupations are recycled and reconsidered through a conversation with somebody else.
There's a... As I said, reading you makes me think of many other writers, many other quotations, and there's one quotation I'd like to read to you rather slowly and carefully, and want you to pay attention to it the way you did to Merwin. It's before Marcel Proust wrote Remembrance of Things Past, he wrote a text which was an introduction to his translation of Ruskin on reading. So it was and Ruskin's text on reading was a text on reading, and Proust wrote a text on reading Ruskin, and translated it. And this is what he says in one of the passages. If we spend the evening with these friends, he's talking about books, it is because we genuinely want to. We often take leave of them, at least only, with regret. And once we have left them, none of those thoughts that spoil friendship, what did they think of us? Were we not tactless? Did they like us? Or the fear of being forgotten in favor of someone else? All these qualms of friendship expire on the threshold of the pure and peaceful form of it that is reading. There's no deference either. We laugh at what Molière has to say only just so far as we find him funny. When he bores us, we are not afraid to look bored. And once we have definitely had enough of him, we put him back in his place as abruptly as if he had neither genius nor celebrity. That made me think of, what does it make you think?
It really cuts both ways, this, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, you could think, how marvelous. What a wonderful resource this is, you can read. But also in that, it seems to me, in Proust, there's a real despair about human relations. That actually, sociability is so difficult and so problematic that, thank God, there's this refuge, which paradoxically is about sociability. So it's a very strange thing he's evoking here, because that's like a man on the run from something, isn't it? A man who really desperately needs. And I think everybody who loves reading knows something about this, that at one level it's a refuge from other people. It's a wonderful hiding place.
And you know, Proust in On Reading talks about the dangers of reading. Reading that becomes a palliative for life.
And also, he is obsessed in the novel about reading people. As though if you can read people like books, you could be okay. Whereas he keeps finding, of course, it really isn't like that.
It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work that way. Because this is why, I mean, in that account, that's why you can't just read psychoanalytic theory instead of having an analysis. It isn't like that. In a way, it makes this issue very vivid. That actually, if you want whatever it is that psychoanalysis has got to offer, you have to have the analysis. You can't just read the books for the same reason.
I also found it interesting, his notion of tact and his notion of jokes, because in your chapter, Not Getting It, you speak about jokes. Mm. And jokes are problematic on so many levels because they demand a response. They're not unlike gifts, which demand... a response as well. Yeah. I've always been surprised in this particular culture in America that there's such a thing as a gift shop, as if a gift could precede its donation. Mm-hmm. Very strange thing. But a joke demands a response. And a joke also excludes. And a joke is also there, to use a word that I very much like, that you use in Missing Out, humiliation.
Jokes, and I mean, in a way you've said it, but jokes are a real test of sociability, aren't they? Because if I tell a joke...
Do you tell jokes?
No. if I say to you, I'm going to tell you a great joke, obviously I can't tell you a great joke, I can tell you a joke, and you will tell me whether it's great in your response. If I was to tell a joke now, it could be excruciatingly embarrassing or a roaring success. But it would be like a sort of love test to the audience. Are we all together in this? Or in fact, am I an isolate? Do I think something's hilarious, which actually nobody is even amused by, or indeed might be embarrassed by? So it's a real test of sociability, a real test of sort of one's relationship to the group. The other bit I think that's very interesting, which is the thing Freud says, which is we never really know what about a joke amuses us. And in that sense, jokes are like sort of tacit communications, in the sense of if we get it, we laugh. But what we don't get is what getting it involves. We don't actually know what we've got. All we know is that we've been amused. And Freud makes, as you know, a lot of this because there is a lot in it. Because it's a very strange form of, you never know with a joke whether it's creating a collusion or a collaboration. You know, whether you've got a sort of gang of accomplices who all share a sense of humor, whether it's a cult, so to speak, or whether it's a group of differently minded people, whether you're coercing a sort of group by a shared sense of humor. And Freud is obviously very onto this because he's wondering what kind of intimacy jokes create? And do they, in a sense, create... do they sort of gloss over differences between people? Are they like magical acts of intimacy? Where people say, well, if we share a sense of humor, then... And I think all those things Freud is suspicious of, not in a cynical way, but in a genuinely questioning way. You know, wondering what we're doing with this stuff.
What... Your response makes me think of one of the comments I hate most, I actually abhor, when people tell you, I know exactly how you feel.
Yeah. But in a way, you wonder why anybody would want somebody to know exactly how they feel. Obviously, I mean, what happens then? Let's say you know exactly how I feel about something. What is it assumed that will then happen as a consequence of this? Because it would seem to me self-evident that people have a limited apprehension of what each other feel.
Maybe nearly none.
No, I think a lot, probably. But I think that it's defended against because the anxiety of closeness or whatever. Nevertheless, it's always going to be approximate. It's never going to be that intimate.
There's a passage I
haven't lost your attention, have I?
Well, but that wouldn't be so bad.
No, well, let's see.
No, you speak about that so interestingly to my mind in terms of children and their attention and how much we should learn from their. What seems so lacking in attention in children actually is something we should pay more attention to.
Yeah, and it's a really exhilarating ruthlessness. That you think you've got this great story you want to read them, and actually if they lose interest, they totally lose interest. And there's absolutely nothing you can do. So in other words, they, insofar as they really live by their desire. And then, of course, they learn to look after us. And so they will sit there dutifully and listen to the story. But actually, you can tell with very little children. If they're not interested, they are not interested.
And another way of saying it is that they're polygamous.
They're promiscuous in their attention. Or their attention is driven by something else other than loyalty.
You didn't lose me. You say we are in actuality something we don't have the wherewithal to recognize. And that seems to me to go in the direction of an unknowability we have towards ourselves.
Yes, I think the thing is that not that we can't know things, but that the risk is that we use knowing in bits of our lives where it doesn't work. Or where it's actually not the point. Because the book is not against, it is sort of against self-knowledge, but it's not against knowing things or knowing people in a way. But what it, I think, is trying to say is something about how in a culture that puts so much value on knowing, it's a bit like the Salins quote, you know, any culture that puts so much value on knowing must be very frightened of not knowing. And, you know, it's very clear that there are limits to, when you say you know someone, it's very hard to know what it is you're really saying. Now, that maybe you can't articulate it, but it could also be something like using knowing where it doesn't work. Or that you
or
might want...
Or there's another form of knowing.
Yes, exactly. It could be a different form.
The form of knowing that strikes me as the most valuable one is one where there's a lot of unknowing
in it,
which is, you know, the knowing that we get when we fall in love, for instance.
Yeah.
And I think that the words are so important in that particular case. We fall, we're off balance, we lose our sense of bearings in some way. But we, insofar that we love someone, we can't quite say why. Loving is not adjectival in some way.
It isn't, but I think in those situations two things are true. We really know that other person's in a profound sense, and we really don't. And you could think that fantasy of knowing is spurred by or prompted by something like, this person has a very, very powerful effect on me, and it's so overwhelming that I'm going to manage this through a fantasy of knowledge. Because I think part of, again, Proust is very interesting about this, that knowing people is often very much about dealing with the anxiety that one can't control them. As though, if I know you or understand you in a certain sense, I will have some sense of sort of what you're doing and where you're going when you're not with me. Whereas, in fact, I don't have any sense. I don't really know that. So it's partly a question of what we use understanding to do. And the example given in the book is, as young children, we listen to adults talking before we understand what they're saying.
An exhilarating moment.
And it's very, very, it's a very, very powerful thing, that. And that's, after all, where we start. We start in a position of not getting it. And it's true of listening to music, too. I mean, The the emotional impact of music is so incommensurate with what people can say about it. And it's, that seems to be very illustrative of something fundamental. That very, very powerful emotional effects often can't be articulated. But you know something's happened to you, but you don't know what it is.
Which brings me back to what I think reading does.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Not... But this chapter, which haunts me, really, the second chapter of your new book, on not getting it, you must be aware of the overtones of not getting it and what that might mean.
Yes, and just the pressure, how much the pressure to get it spoils one's experience of it. Because if you read a poem and one way or another you're urging yourself or being urged by an institution to understand it, the experience of reading the poem is very different. If you're just, it's again a bit like what Moen was saying about pleasure. If you read the poem in a way that gives you pleasure, or if the poem gives you pleasure, then you can have an experience of it. The risk is that the will to understand preempts the experience of it. And I think, you know, your question would be, well, why would you want that? And the answer would be, because the experience could be disturbing. Not simply you will feel things you don't want to feel, but the pleasure could be disturbing. Not just the suffering, as it were.
The pleasure in what you discover might be disturbing.
Or what you feel, what the poem actually evokes in you, what it calls up in you. Which you may not be able to articulate, but you'll, and again, you'll find yourself going back to certain poems again and again. After all, there are only sort of 50 words on a page. But you go back because something that really matters to you is evoked in you by the words. And if somebody said to you, well, what is it? Or what does your favourite poem mean? You may well be able to answer it if you've been educated in a certain way. But I think you'll feel the gap, probably, between what you are able to say and why you go on reading it. And that's why, because obviously partly the book is to do with psychoanalysis, in the sense that a psychoanalysis that's bent on understanding people is going to be very, very limited and preemptive, I think. It's much more about some sort of experience that goes on between people that could be described as an unconscious exchange or something like that. But it's not merely re-describing somebody such that they become like a character in a novel. It's really showing you how much your wish to know yourself is a consequence of an anxiety state about what it's like to live yourself not knowing what's going on.
And how much perhaps you need to live in that way of not knowing.
Or there's no other way to live. That's what's happening anyway, actually. But it's concealed or covered up or assuaged partly by fantasies of knowing who we are. When people say, I'm the kind of person who, my heart always sinks, because you always think, well, sort of, or maybe. But, you know, it's not the whole truth, and it's a bit like your quotations. These are formulas. We've all got about 10 formulas about who we are, what we like, kind of people we like, and all that stuff. And it's actually often really banal and really, really repetitive. And the disparity between how one experiences oneself, as it were, minute by minute, and these phrases is ludicrous. It's like the caption under a painting. You think, well, yeah, I can see it's called that, but...
Three quotations come to mind in Missing Out. One of them, the first one I'll read, seems to me so important, from Randall Jarrell. Mm. The way we miss our lives is life. This I want more about.
It's a great, I mean, it's a
it's
great
just
line.
Fantastic.
It's a brilliant line. Well, partly this is an example of the thing we're talking about. Because
yeah,
when you say that, you see, I think, what is it about? Now,
I don't even want you to tell me, Adam, what it's about.
No, but I could say something about it.
But I must say, I want you to say something about it. But before you do, I read this so many times, and I thought, my goodness, this is fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
But I just, and it's just a few words.
Yeah.
It could have been your seven words, which I will tell in a little while.
Yeah.
But what does it mean? And do I want to know what it means? But my goodness, it is so true.
Yeah, or, yes. Or
and it is so painful because it is so true.
What's painful about it?
Okay, I won't answer. Tell me what it
is. No, go on, seriously. Seriously, what is painful about it? You mean as though there's only loss?
Well, loss interests me greatly. Yeah.
Because it could be extremely comforting, couldn't it? It could be a way of saying, actually, that's what a life is. It's the lives you don't have. As if to say, don't worry, because that's what a life is. You shouldn't be thinking,
you're telling
God,
me
how can I live
worry?
All this? No, I'm not telling you anything. But just generally, what I'm saying is, there could be a comfort in that line. And the comfort would be something like, you don't have to worry about trying to have the lives you think you're missing.
Really?
You could just think, the way we miss our lives is life. Or you could think, this is terrible. If this is true, it's a catastrophe. Because we're always in a state of irredeemable mourning.
I think I'm approaching more the latter than the former. But what does that mean? I mean, it means a lot of things. But do you approach it more in the first way of looking at it?
No, I think both things are true. You know,
and that is what is interesting to my mind, is that both things are true, and that your work is always about the ambivalence. Mm. And it's always about the in-between. Mm. It's always about the fact that both things can be true, and it is both all right and a catastrophe.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And one's going to feel different things at different times. Like the thing Emerson said, you know, our moods don't believe in each other. Well, there's a certain mood in which you will feel...
Emerson said that.
There's a mood in which you'll feel this is a terrible fact about life, that we're always going to be preoccupied by what we're missing and there's no way around it. And in another mood, we could think, well, that's what it is to live a life. So get used to it. That's the point. It's not the problem, it's the point.
Okay. Well, you on Kissing, Tickling and Being Bored, you have this line, which in a way works very well together with Randall Jarrell. One's real life is so often the life that one does not lead.
That's wild, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. And it made me think of Rimbaud's line, "La vraie vie est absente." Real life is absent, which, you know, Godard then misquotes in Pierrot le Fou, where he says, "La vraie vie est ailleurs," the real life is elsewhere. That, which interests me also because the Godard quotation is the one we remember most. So we remember the misquotation.
And you could see why we might.
Yeah. A line that I very much like in Missing Out is a line from John Ashbery. "The worse your art is, the easier it is to talk about it."
That's the best quote in the book.
It is the best quote. Why? I mean, because it made me also think about... I mean, it put into question my whole life in some way.
Well, I won't respond to that now. Okay. But the Ashbery quote seems to me to be wonderful because it's, in a way, it acknowledges that sense in which we're living in a dream, not living the interpretation of one. So that actually, the reason one does what one does is precisely because one can't give an account of it, if you see what I mean. So that people are really absorbed in something. It is very often the case that they can only do the thing that they do. Which is why often people who write or paint or whatever find critics very, very difficult. Either because obviously they're not being praised enough, or alternatively because it feels sort of irrelevant. It feels necessary, because clearly art is buoyed up by responses to it, but also somehow irrelevant. And again, it's very true in a different way in psychoanalysis, which I'm sure is not a great deal of interest to everybody here, but there's a whole range of analysts who can give extremely fluent, elaborate accounts of how they do psychoanalysis. And you always think, if it's like that, then surely they're not doing it. Because psychoanalysis is about the unconscious. How could you know what you were doing on that scale? So it seems to me, in a way, that, you know, the better your psychoanalysis is, the less able you'll be able to talk about it. But of course, that would also be true of the terrible things people do. This is the bind of it. But I think what Ashbery is just making a very simple salutary point, which is we should wonder about people's fluency about what they're doing in relation to what they actually do. Just that.
And in some way, does that explain or express the way in which you approach your own work, which, to my mind, is a form of caress? It's concentric. You haunt your subjects. You approach them from different angles. You surprise them. You try to encircle them, and then you can't quite get to them. You release them, and then with other quotations or the same quotations, you come back to them in the subsequent book.
Well, you see, in a way, that might be why why I would have a conversation with you, because the experience is that I just write. And I'm sure what you're saying is true, so to me, sounds true, but my experience of doing it is I just write it. There's nothing else really I can say about it except that that's how it comes out. But then you can read it and you can say something like that back to me, and then I could think about it. But if you said to me, what are you doing in the doing it, I've got no idea. Because what I'm doing in doing it is doing it.
Why do you do it?
Just because I love doing it. And because there's a sort of drive to do it. It gives me a huge amount of pleasure to do it. And because I find it so easy. Because it's so available to me.
So easy to write.
Yeah.
Which isn't the case with analysis at all.
No, analysis I find difficult, but writing I don't.
And you write in a very particular way. You write with what one might call a routine. Yeah. You have a very deliberate way of writing. You write on a day of the week.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, you write. What happens during the other days when you're not writing? You're seeing patients, but...
I don't think about it at all.
Really?
I literally don't think about it consciously. I mean, when I'm working, I do the work. I'm not all the time thinking about the thing I'm writing. Not at all. It literally stops more or less when I stop. And in that sense, it's a bit like, although it isn't really, but it's a bit like automatic writing in the sense of I do it and I revise bits and pieces, but not much. And then when it stops, I stop doing it. And then I'll do it again when I have another space to do it. Because sometimes I have a couple of hours, say, in the day, in which case I will use those hours to do it when I'm actually writing something. But otherwise, it is just in that day that I do it. And that works. It's just, I wouldn't be better for me to have more time, I don't think.
You mentioned critics. Critics write about you. You know, it was amusing to see a few weeks before you came here that you were on the approval matrix.
What's that? Well,
I'll tell you. I didn't really know either. But the New York Magazine considers certain writers cool. And you were considered cool. And approved by...
Can I just say something about that?
Yeah.
Before I left, I was going off to have a haircut, and my son, who is 6, said to me as I was leaving, "You are so not cool." And I said, "Good." And there was a pause. I could see he was waiting to say something even worse. And then he said to me, "Even after you've had a haircut, you won't look like Justin Bieber." So...
I think he was right. So you were put on this approval matrix, which means that you're celebrated by a group of readers who read New York Magazine as being cool, regardless of what your son believes. What does it mean to get Adam Phillips?
I couldn't possibly answer that. I mean, all I can know is the things that people say to me about the books when they read them. And I don't have a wish. I mean, obviously, it's not up to me. But my wish isn't that people read the books and then go away with these theories that I've supposedly got. What I want is people enjoy the experience of reading the books, and then they forget about them. They have their own thoughts, and that's it. But I'm not trying to promote consciously anyway a set of theories or ideas. There's a spirit, I think, in the writing. There must be. But it's really about, you read this book because it gives you pleasure or because you hate it. You read it for those sorts of reasons. And then you find what you find yourself thinking, feeling in the reading of it. But that's it. I don't want to add anything to psychoanalytic theory at all or any other kind of theory.
There you're talking less of your critics and more of your readers. Do you make a distinction?
I get two kinds of reviews. One kind of review says, this is narcissistic, self-indulgent, pretentious, empty. Don't be impressed and don't be fooled. And then I get another kind of review which says, these books are interesting. And it's always one of the two things. And clearly, they're, you know, from their own points of view, they're both right. But all I can do is, you know, can't write differently. And I, you know, I'm very, very fortunate because I don't have to earn my living by writing. So I really don't have to think about that stuff. And I don't mean it doesn't impinge upon me, but I don't have to be preoccupied by it. So I just go on doing it, and insofar as people want to go on publishing and so on, then that's what happens. But I don't write to get good reviews. It just isn't like that.
You don't care?
I do care, but I don't. It's not the point of doing it. So if somebody was to write a devastating review of my book, I wouldn't give up. I know that, because it just isn't that kind of thing for me.
I think, I mean, you use the word pleasure and the word appetite. I mean, that's what it really is about.
Yeah, that's what it is about, yeah. Yeah.
Now you're writing a biography of Freud. Mm. When you began, I mean, what drew you to psychoanalysis? I mean, I imagine it's a number of things, but early on, one of the formative experiences was reading the autobiography of Carl Jung. Mm. And then you moved away from Carl Jung and studied Winnicott and many other analysts. And now you're writing a biography of Freud.
Why am I doing it?
Yeah, why are you doing it? I mean, yeah, why are you doing it, Adam? Yes. What do you hope to... As I say this, I know it's completely the wrong question.
No, no, I'm not. I'm really not sure it is, actually, because...
I haven't yet asked the question.
Sorry.
The question being, I wonder what it is you think you might discover, which is a wrong question because you don't know.
No, but, I'll tell you, no, but there's a different idea behind the book, which is not... There isn't, at least a contrary, to discover anything in that sense about Freud. What I want to do is write a biography of Freud which incorporates within the book his own misgivings about writing biographies. So that it's a book, it could be terribly pretentious or very, very boring, but the project is to be able to write his life, because nobody needs another biography of Freud, and there are very, very good ones, actually. But to write a short biography, in the light of the previous biographies that can say something or include something about his doubts about what is in some ways a very absurd but very absorbing genre, which is biographies. I'll give you just briefly a simple example. Freud makes a huge palaver about not going to Rome. He desperately wants to go to Rome, can't go there for all sorts of reasons. In 1902, I think it is 1904, he finally goes with his brother. Peter Gay says something like, in 1902, Freud eventually conquered Rome. He went as a tourist. Jones says something like, Freud entered Rome in triumph. This is astounding. And you can see, obviously, what's going on here.
What is?
Well, what seems to be going on is there's a rhetorical enforcement of a fantasy of Freud as a hero. Well, Freud says, when people write biographies, they idealize their subjects or demonize them, because they're writing them according to their own desire of the subject, you know, what they want from him. Well, Jones, I mean, understandably, Jones and Peter Gay want Freud to be an extraordinarily masterful person who is having it. So there's a huge palaver in both his books about Freud's self-analysis. It's a great heroic thing. Well, it was an impressive thing to do, but plenty of people have done things like that in the past, as Freud knew. People have gone through crises in their lives and tried to work them out through writing and through conversations. Now, what came out of this one was the invention of psychoanalysis, and of course, that is very remarkable to the people who love psychoanalysis. But Freud was writing in a long spiritual, religious tradition of kind of crisis writing, when it's as though you've come to the end of something in yourself and you need to do something else. And it's very, very interesting. But it's not, you know, the transfiguration of the Magi. It's a limited thing. So, and it's not that I want to write a sort of anti-heroic, disparaging book of Freud at all. It's not that.
It isn't like Malraux did the anti-mémoire.
No, absolutely not. But it's much more seeing if it's possible to entertain Freud's fantasy of a realistic biography.
What would that mean?
Well, I'm doing it and trying to find out. And it may not be a possible thing to do.
Because?
Because in the act of writing, you are rhetorically... I mean, A, as Freud says about biographers, they have a desire in relation to their subjects. There's a reason why they're doing it, and they want this figure to be something for them. So I can't absolve myself. I can be more or less explicit. It's a bit like, you know, Brechtian theatre, where every so often the characters turn around and say something about the play they're in. Well, it would be like a version of that. It might be like a version of that, and it could be terrible. But it would be a version of saying, what's going on when, if you think of the disparity between living every minute of your life and the 300 pages of a biography, how can we claim to know what somebody was thinking, feeling, wanting, etc., when, A, they are not them? Freud's dislike of biography is because it isn't psychoanalysis. In psychoanalysis, the patient can answer back. In biography, they can't. And that's the difference. And it's a very interesting difference. It doesn't mean the biographies are no good. It just means they're very, very different.
They're different, and they fail because they believe they can be omniscient.
Yes, or they're like bad novels. The bad ones. And the good ones are like good novels that are slightly different from good novels. But I don't know what the difference is, if you see what I mean. I don't know that.
There's a whole chapter in your book, which is, in a way, a long analysis of one poem. I'd like us to listen to Philip Larkin's poem, and then for you to say something about it.
This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had, and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can, and don't have any kids yourself.
Interesting laughter at the end.
It's what Freud calls the laughter of unease. I mean, it's a very disturbing and amusing poem, actually, because it's about the determination not to do something that you can't actually know anything about until you've done it. And it can't help but retrospectively reflect on his experience of his parents. And indeed, he writes in a letter, I can't remember who it is, to somebody saying, you know, I'm very worried that this is going to be the... I'm very worried of the effect of this on my parents if this becomes my most famous poem or the poem I'm known for. And you can see why.
Your reading of the poem stresses in particular the ending.
Yes, partly because I'm using it for my own purposes, but I think that the end of the poem, get out as early as you can, don't have any kids yourself, is, on the one hand, it says very clearly what it doesn't want, but what it finds more difficult to say is what it does want. So again, it's to do with the consequences. So you get out as early as you can, and you don't have any kids. And then what kind of life is possible for you? Well, it's not as though, I mean, there's no way of saying that. It could be wonderfully exhilarating. You don't know that. But it's as though he has an absolute determination about something, that something has been a catastrophe for him in some way, or there's something about it, even if it wasn't literally a catastrophe, that he can't bear the thought of replicating. As though the culture could encourage him in some way, just simply to do the same thing again. And this is a sort of...
And the culture
could do, absolutely. And Larkin isn't saying, I'm an extraordinarily rebellious individual for repudiating this. It just says, don't do it. A bit like, don't repeat the cycle. Because when it says, man hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. It's a very odd image, because misery doesn't deepen like a coastal shelf, and coastal shelves don't always deepen. But it's a bit like he's saying, this is like a geological force. There's a sort of erosion myth here. This is what's going to happen, and actually, misery increases transgenerationally. Now, maybe that's true. It's not as though I think it isn't true, but it seems to me it isn't entirely true. but something makes Larkin feel that's the warning he needs to give us. Because after all, the warning is to us. It's a very prescriptive poem. It says, this is how you should live. Leave home as early as possible. Don't have any children.
Patients come to see you who want to leave each other and who have children and who so often use the children as a way of saying that they can't leave each other. Does this poem help you in some way understand what it is they're struggling with?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think it's difficult to understand what people are struggling with. And it is terrible, as anybody who's been through it knows. But I think what the poem does is it at least keeps alive the part of ourselves, if there is one, that doesn't want to have children. You know, I mean, Darwin says, straightforwardly, we want to survive, and if we can survive well enough, we want to reproduce. Freud says there's a part of ourselves that doesn't want to survive, that wants to die, and sex is actually mostly not about reproduction. So Freud produces a counter-Darwinian myth, and whether or not it's true, it's very useful, it seems to me, to have that in the picture, because there are people for whom, or moods in which, for all of us, we don't want to survive and we don't want to reproduce. And Larkin, I think, is because in some ways it's a very bitter poem, this, but it's attempting a sort of, there is a better life here, but it depends upon not having a family. Now, of course, for loads of people, that's true. It's not that this is an idiotic prescription or a cynical one, but it at least keeps alive in the culture the idea that a heterosexual man can avoid the pressures to simply replicate his family of origin in some way.
And it keeps alive also, I think, in people who have children, the possibility of what it would be to live a life
Absolutely.
Without children.
And it reminds them of their ambivalence about their children.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that we are all very disturbed by the fact that we love and hate our children. And we'd rather have feelings about them that we like, understandably.
You've said to me that children are unbearable.
They are sometimes, yeah. But
I mean,
it's very,
but
very...
Hearing a word such as unbearable from you makes me pause.
Well, it depends on our individual experiences, but one of my experiences about having children is that you feel so intensely about your children that there's something unbearable. I don't mean all the time, but intermittently they are so evocative and one feels such a passion for them that there's something unbearable about sometimes. I'm not
they
talking
remind
about,
us of ourselves.
Well, they remind
in,
us,
in
yes.
Ways
yeah, and they remind us of our vulnerability, and they remind us of how little we can protect them from. And we remind us of just how unprotected we are from our feelings for each other. And I think every parent feels this.
In closing, or nearly closing, another line you use again and again and again from Emerson, which I really love, from experience. The individual is always mistaken. He designed many things and drew in other persons as co-adjutors. Let me try that again. The individual is always mistaken. He designed many things and drew in other persons as co-adjutors, quarreled with some or all, blundered much, and something is done. All are a little advanced, but the individual is always mistaken. It turns out somewhat new and very unlike what he promised himself.
Isn't
I love
brilliant?
It.
It's fantastic.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Well, Emerson agrees with Freud in a completely different way. Emerson agrees with Freud in that he believes that our mistakes are as truthful as our competence. And that you can't design your life, because a life isn't that kind of thing.
Your Freud will be closer to a romantic Freud?
Yeah. it won't be Freud as a sort of, it won't be Freud as a reductive megalomaniac scientist. It'll be much more Freud as an ordinary Jewish man with six children trying to make a career, happening upon something that really disturbs him. So discovering, in a sense, psychoanalysis, and then it generating tremendous panic, what's being opened up. And then there's sort of the institutionalization of it, the grouping around of it, the attempt to control it, because it begins to proliferate. Once you let people say what comes into their minds, they say all sorts of things. And you begin to feel all sorts of things. And it's very difficult to contain it. So Freud discovers something that he's very disturbed by, that's also very, very exhilarating and extraordinary. So that's going to be the kind of story. So it's a romantic myth story.
Well, you said something that made the audience laugh. You discover all kinds of things. You speak about psychoanalysis in that way. Mm. When we start to speak, it's a line you are part of my lines. And one of the lines I use again and again and again, quoting you, is that, and you have wonderful things to say about flattery, when we flatter other people, other people's work, something actually is occurring in that moment. But you say that when we speak, things fall out of our pockets. Mm-hmm. And that is really what psychoanalysis does.
And it says, but at its best, it doesn't say, and that will make you better. It says, if you allow that to happen, then your life will be different. And it's actually impossible to know whether it'll be better or worse. It's a risk. But you might feel it's a risk worth taking. It's a sort of modern risk that is available to affluent-ish people. I don't mean by that it's only suited to affluent people at all, because I know that to be untrue. But mostly, they are the only people who will have access to it, unfortunately. But it's something that everybody can use if they like it.
In closing, a passage from Monogamy. There are fundamentally two kinds of writers, just as there are two kinds of monogamist, the immaculate and the fallible. For the immaculate, every sentence must be perfect, every word the inevitable one. For them, getting it right is a point. For the fallible, wrong is only the word for people who need it to be right. The fallible, that is to say, have the courage of their gaucheness. They are never quite sure what might be a good line, and they have a superstitious confidence that the bad lines somehow sponsor the good ones. Do you find yourself in one or another of those?
By aspiration, yeah. I mean, obviously I would want to be the fallible kind, because I would want to feel that in the writing I could try things out and I could risk being possibly pretentious, gauche, all things I would rather not be seen to be, to find out what it's like. So you don't, anybody writes knows, you don't write things you believe. You write to find out what you do believe or to find out what you can afford to believe. So when I write something and it sounds good, I leave it in usually. Even if I can see that it might not sound good to somebody else, or to somebody else it might sound sort of awful or brash or something. But I want to be able to have the courage of my brashness in that sense. Writing things, I don't leave things in that I know to be terrible, or that I don't, as it were, believe. I don't do that. But if there's a doubt about it, and it sounds interesting, I leave it in. And I want to be free to do that. Because that's, in a way, why I do it. Because when I write, things occur to me. It's a way of thinking.
They occur to you as you're writing.
When I'm writing, that's entirely what happens.
When you're reading, do you underline?
No. But I do put dots occasionally by bits.
Dots?
Dots. One dot.
Small dot?
Very small dot.
Because those are the passages you will...
But it's like a sort of fantasy, this, because actually what happens is I usually never look at the book again. But
you never look at the book again?
No, I mean, I might reread it, but I reread a new copy. I never reread the same book I've read.
Really?
Because the dots. So there's that bit. But the other bit is that when I write, I can remember things, see? When I'm actually writing, I remember quotations or I remember where they are. Whereas when I'm not writing,
well,
I can't remember anything.
Yes, because yeah. These quotations.
But most of the time, I literally can't remember anything or where things come from. But in the well, emotion of writing, I can do that.
What is it about having a bad memory that is helpful?
I just believe in unconscious work. It's like a, you know, it's like a superstition. I just think all the best work is unconscious.
You know that passage in Beckett, the book he wrote about Proust, he says Proust had a bad memory.
Yeah, of course. How else could he have written the book?
Your seven words are, I am a child psychotherapist who also writes.
Yeah.
That's it?
That's it. In seven words, that's it, yeah. Because everything for me came out of doing child psychotherapy.
The writing as well.
I think everything. Yeah, I mean, it can't literally be true, but yes, that was the experience of all those years doing it.
The missing we experience, the missing out we experience, the fact that we put so much more effort in some way in our lives, in imagining our lives, fantasizing about our lives, wishing our lives, and not quite having that life. Is that in some way painful?
Well, we know it is, but it might be like the Gerald quote, which is, the wishing might be part of having the life. The misleading thing would be to be too literal about it and think, every time I have a wish, I could sort of be striving to gratify it. It may be part of growing up, that you acknowledge that some things you just experience as wishes.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you.